Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. I'm thrilled to welcome today's guest, Kate Bowler, host of the podcast Everything Happens and the author of numerous best-selling books. I woke up at 2 a.m. last night drenched in sweat, throwing bedding off of me. Every pet was also on top of me, which probably didn't help. Many nights, I have the opposite problem, where I'm hunting in the hall closet for extra blankets in the wee hours because I'm freezing. In part, this is because my husband and I have wildly different sleep temperature preferences, and I'm cold because he's left all the sliding doors in our house wide open. But there's actually a solution I've come to learn, and I'm all about a sleep solution because we know how important good, uninterrupted sleep is for every facet of health. Have you heard about ChiliPad by SleepMe? It's a bed cooling system designed to revolutionize the way you sleep naturally. The ChiliPad bed cooling system is your new bedtime solution. It lets you customize your sleeping environment to your optimal temperature, ensuring you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. ChiliPad works with your existing mattress. It's a water-based mattress topper that continuously controls your bed temperature from 55 to 115 degrees. You can also choose a different setting than your partner, so you each get what you need. What I want? A cool mattress with piles of blankets on top. ChiliPad believes sleeping at the optimal temperature helps people naturally reach their highest potential physically and mentally. Visit www.sleep.me/thread to get your ChiliPad and save up to $315 with code THREAD. This offer is available exclusively for Pulling the Thread listeners and only for a limited time. Order it today with free shipping and try it out for 30 days. You can return it for free if you don't like it with their sleep trial. Visit www.sleep.me/thread because you're not just investing in better sleep, you're creating a better life. Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. On this show, we pull apart the web in which we all live to understand who we are and why we're here. Pulling the Thread is about big questions. Why we do what we do, how we can understand our own experiences within a larger spiritual and historical context, the ways in which we might begin to understand ourselves and each other better, and what's required to heal ourselves and our world. I'll be joined in conversation by luminaries and wise elders, those who have laid tracks in their work and lives to help us bring meaning and understanding to a world that often feels chaotic and overwhelming. My hope is that these conversations spark moments of resonance and plant tiny seeds of awareness so that we might all collectively learn and grow.
I'm really hopeful that we're evolving past our very hyper-individualistic understanding of like, my health, wealth, and happiness is the great goal. And that we're trying to like fold in a more collective and I hope generous sense that like, Our lives will require love. Our lives will require courage and interdependence, you know, and it's probably going to never follow along any of our demographic, political, religious, sociocultural, you know, dreams that advertising companies have for us. But instead, it's going to require a very collective sense of what can we become.
So says Kate Bowler. And it's not without a dose of irony that Professor Kate Bowler, a prolific historian and author about the prosperity gospel, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer at the age of 35. After all, her work had revolved around parsing a spiritual point of view that if you were a good person, a good Christian, good things would invariably happen, like wealth and health. From this diagnosis, she wrote a best-selling book, Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved, and added an entirely new dimension to her scholarship at Duke. She's now in remission and the host of the Everything Happens podcast and has written several more bestsellers, including books of devotionals like The Lives We Actually Have and Good Enough. In today's conversation, we covered a lot of ground, the inherent goodness of people, when we rise to the occasion and when we don't, and whether evil as an absolute exists. Okay, let's get to our conversation.
Hey, congratulations. I'm so happy for you. You have crushed this last season. Every time I see you, it's something with you in it and your beautiful face, I just feel joy.
Thank you. Oh. Well, I feel like I'm trying to follow in your footsteps. I don't know how you're minting these books so fast.
That's right.
In fact, I wrote about you in the final chapter because of your ability to sort of visibly experience so many things simultaneously and almost instantaneously.
Well, I'm halfway through, so that gives me an exciting, very narcissistic ending. So thank you, my love. That's so nice.
Hopefully you think I do you justice. You and Nora are in there. Aww. I wanted to do something slightly different and not like break formats or anything like that, but write a book for not a space like in the market. It's not, I don't like that sort of, but I wanted to write something that would be hard to quantify. Is it about culture or religion or spirituality or agnosticism? Is it about men or women? I don't know. And it's the sort of book, I think, too, where I worked really hard to bring together all these disparate thinkers and threads and weave them together. And so I feel like for the really hardcore academic, they'll read it and be like, this is fun. Yeah. And for some women, it's like, oh, I've never actually even attempted nonfiction. And I did it. And so it sort of lives in its own space, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it really does. I like that a lot. It does like open up then what we're allowed to do and then what other people, just to not create yet another how-to book where someone, you know, re-describes the ending of Good Will Hunting. And then, I think it's kind of wonderful to feel interdisciplinary. And I do always think that at the beginning, at the end of the book, I always go, what three disciplines does this, what three primary set of sources did this draw from? And I always like the fact that the answer is like, not the normal ones.
Yeah.
So like cultural history, like personal experience. And for me, usually like some kind of iteration of kind of like historical theology. And then for them, I'm like, great, done, super. I mean, it's not somebody else's brain. It's just one that's my little braid. And I like having a little braid.
Well, I think it's really important. And I feel this way about your work too, in that it puts me a little bit, it's not on my back foot, but like I like work where I'm like, I don't know exactly what Kate believes. I don't actually know as much as you are revealing about your life and the way that you've processed and the things that you've studied and where you come from. But there's something that is certainly not prescriptive, even as you're offering
that's
blessings.
Nice. Well, thanks for saying that. I do. Yeah. I've been reading a lot of, I know people love a good list and people love a good inventory, personal inventory. But man, it is really nice to kind of swim around in someone's brain without having felt like they just gave you a prescriptive list.
Well, and it would be so antithetical to everything that you stand for, which is in a way, how do you make friends with uncertainty? And how do you get comfortable with darkness and loss and hard moments and not only maintain your sense of humor, but also stay open to dig deeper and rather than.
Yeah, totally. Become the certainty police.
Yes.
Yeah, totally.
Yes. Yeah. And the certainty police is very compelling, but it is such a lie.
It's so true. It's so true. Yeah. That's so funny.
So how are you? How's your health? How are you? Everything seems gangbusters, which is probably overwhelming in its own way.
I'm feeling really good right now. I just had a good scan a couple weeks ago, and I've got to wait and have one other little procedure and kind of find out where I'm at. But I think I'm in a really good spot. So that is, I can always feel sort of the horizon open up when that happens. And so I'm feeling really good. This last year was harder than I wished it were, because I had this just brutal year of chronic pain where I had, it's because of all the abdominal surgeries I've had, it just kept, it just kind of pushed over a set of dominoes. And so I really only had about 45 minutes of clear brain space a day. And that made me very, is it happening now? Do I have to concentrate? But I found ways to kind of fill that time with something creative and good. And then the rest of the time, honestly, I was just trying to get through as best I could. So
yeah.
I feel great that so much of that is cleared up. I just feel kind of like a brand new little baby.
Really? So the pain has dissipated. And did you ever figure out what it was?
Yeah. I've been doing like a nutso regimen of different kinds of physical therapy and trying to mash it together. And just, I had a theory about if I combined a couple things and did these appointments like multiple times a day, I was like, I bet you anything it'll work. But it's just me trying to gerrymander my own kind of care. But then it worked. So it took about 3 months for me to even just be able to drop the amount of like intense pain meds I was on. But then all of a sudden, the fog clears, a brain works again. And then I just felt, just gloriously new. So I'm still in it. I still do a lot of appointments, but I'm so much better than I was even a few months ago.
Oh, good. Oh, Kate. I mean, you're such a fascinating person to watch in the world for all of these reasons. Again, like your ability to hold conflicting ideas simultaneously and move through them and reflect them back to us. Obviously, I think you become sort of a beacon. And then how do you think, obviously, however many years ago, you would never have said, like, this is the space. This is my, like, this is my cabin in culture. Come hither.
Yes. Totally. No, never. I never would have thought that. It's true. And because at the beginning, when I first started writing about, like, feeling exiled from the world of health, wealth, and happiness, I think I was also just so lonely that the second I started to feel the companionship of having ideas and then being able to share them with other people, that was just so wonderfully addicting, because I've made most of my good friends and like sort of emotional, intellectual companions for the journey by doing this work out loud. So it's just funny that it's changed my life so much, in terms of my like network of friends, or even just imagining the kind of books I would write. I never, ever, 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 ever would have presumed to write like even more like a book of blessings or something like that. Cause before I was so disciplined into like, Kate Bowler, you will stay in your lane, and your lane is that you're an effing historian, and you will write, those books take 6 years and you will sit alone until they're done. So this has been actually a much less lonely, much friendlier way of kind of sharing the ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously sort of the great irony, right, that you were a historian specifically of prosperity gospel and this idea of like goodness precedes all the good things of life, right? They're tethered together, and then you have a much more complex experience. And then it's interesting just even thinking about who you are and who you're becoming and who you've been for people. And this idea of everything happens for a reason and other lies I've loved and No Cure for Being Human, which is another gorgeous book. But it's also, I want to say, like, maybe everything does happen for a reason on some sort of grander scale, right? Like there is
your love for me in that, in saying that, I really feel it, because you're like, look, you have stuck a landing on being in a vocationally open space. And I do feel like everything's meaningful, but it's different than saying that everything's causal. Cause I have felt like, I spent my whole 20s interviewing televangelists and megachurch preachers and learning all about this very intense religious world called the prosperity gospel, which does say that everything is super hypercausal. You do this, if you're good, good things will happen to you. If you're bad, bad things will happen to you. And so, good luck, person who gets stage 4 cancer. Good luck. And so In wanting to move away from that, because I mean, the burden of that is that all of our choices then feel so fraught. And then we feel like we're always trying to, you know, we're just sort of like we look in our hands and all of a sudden we're like, our hands are full of puzzle pieces that don't fit. And then we're just trying to like mash them in, because otherwise we won't get that beautiful feeling we get when we look at the big picture. But I totally agree though, my love, that like we do sometimes end up with these mountaintop moments where we get to look back and say, man, like some things really came together so beautifully that I couldn't have orchestrated, but now I feel the coherence of like, so, you know, being able to be an expert in one thing that I genuinely did learn lessons from in the end.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, to think about your books, which are largely memoir, right? But they're also in the context of you as a historian. And in writing, you know, my own book that is a blend, and you're contextualizing my own life against this larger backdrop, which is similar, I think, to what you do. But also for you to say, okay, I'm going to be a historian here, a diagnosing abstract from a place of remove about this corner of Christianity, and then to actually be sort of drawn by the nose forcefully into it is also quite cosmic, to actually have to go into it and to bring insert yourself into sort of the this version that doesn't align with most of our lived experience, unless you're Joel Osteen and you have like $500 million, I don't know, and a lot of Ferraris and Porsches.
Yeah. Yes, I do think that was the big, I guess what happened with cancer and with the feeling of the limitations of my own life was it felt like a grand humbling. Like, Kate, whatever you thought you were going to get to do, you know, with your 80 years of academic life and your grateful fleet of graduate students and your many, many leather-bound books, I had a very clear, clean ladder-like sense of how it was supposed to go. And then to have that all wiped away, but then in that leveling, feels so much more of like a sense of real purpose. And like, well, now that I'm here, now that I'm Ariel style where the people are, I felt so much more interconnected. And then in a way, so much freer to say, well, now that I'm here, you know, what else can we learn when life comes undone? And that sense of then connection with other people, I do think has probably been the most meaningful part of my life. And now I can't even imagine. So I've now spent maybe 5 years being able to, like, when I go somewhere, I get to hear all of these stories of other people whose lives come undone. And that very horizontal, cracked open sense of the world has honestly totally changed how I think, and I hope how I interact.
Wondering what to give your mom or wife or daughter or friend or godmother for Mother's Day? From someone who cares a lot about her bed and sleep, may I recommend something from Cozy Earth? In fact, becoming a mom and suffering through its required sleep deprivation is where my obsession with sleep started. So it's one of those gifts that might really bring things full circle. After all, women in particular are really impacted by sleep deprivation, which has massive implications for our health. Between the hypervigilance of motherhood and the hot flashes of perimenopause and menopause, we get a raw sleep deal. So let me tell you about giving women you love their best night's sleep ever. Let me tell you about Cozy Earth. Their sheets are made from viscose from bamboo, and they are indescribably soft. So soft, like a bed hug like no other. Now, I'm not the only mega Cozy Earth fan. Every single year since 2018, Cozy Earth products have been named as one of Oprah's favorite things. Oprah picked their best-selling bamboo sheet set because they're temperature regulating and incredibly soft, and she picked their joggers and their socks and their pajamas. Meanwhile, Cozy Earth doesn't just make sheets, they also make pillows, blankets, and more. Cozy Earth makes their products by sourcing responsibly. They use the best suppliers with an eye toward quality, responsible production, cutting-edge technology, and premium materials. They're also incredibly durable. They get better with every wear, and they have an enhanced weave that is guaranteed not to pill even after washing and drying. All Cozy Earth products can be returned or exchanged within 100 days and include an additional 10-year warranty against defects. This Mother's Day, treat mom to the luxury she deserves with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear and prioritize her self-care and sleep health. She deserves it. Don't forget to use my promo code THREAD at checkout for 35% off at CozyEarth.com. After placing your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows so they know that we sent you. As you're speaking, it's like that's also the story of what you've studied at its source, right? Like the great everyone, you know, leaving everything or losing everything, being cast into the desert, like deep despair is sort of the heart of all of the, you know, Judeo-Christian religions. How do you think about, I don't even know, interestingly, like reading your books and then knowing sort of some of your interests. I loved your conversation with Elaine Pagels. I love her and her work. How do you define your faith and where do you find, what interests you? Like what draws you in deeper?
That's such a big, lovely question. I'm very Jesus-y. So which is to say, I feel the hilarious tension of having like big cosmic beliefs about things, God is love, et cetera, et cetera. And then also constantly being drawn into the absurd and wonderful particularity of like one dude's story. And I think that's what's so funny about revelatory religion, right? Is we feel like we get a story and then we're supposed to peer through a keyhole at the rest of life. And that is, I guess, what I find so compelling about, I've studied Christian history for a long time. And I guess that's what I find so compelling about the story about how we learn to belong in the community of faith is we are, you know, we're called to a really small set of claims about love of neighbor and a God who will never be separated from us, and a story about how somehow God completes and saves the world despite our many, many apocalypses, and how we're like determined to destroy ourselves and everyone around us. And like, I find those set of themes endlessly fascinating over and over and over again. So like, it's usually the same set of questions, like, well, then what does it mean to be a person of hope? Or like, what does it mean to have courage? You know, how much in the face of unknowing does it require that we constantly get back up again? God, why do you keep requiring interdependence of me? I'm not good at it and I don't like it. And then how much do we get broken down and broken in by learning how to be defined by love? And like those four little themes, I swear to God, I am interested in them spiritually and intellectually forever and always. And that's, I think, fundamentally how I think about what are the big sort of notes in the song of what I hope is Christian faith.
Yeah. So interesting. I also love Jesus and, you know, grew up, my dad's Jewish, and I sort of had this white bread version, Wonder Bread version of Jesus where I was like, you know, and you hear, I just like sort of grew up in the soup of parents who would probably call themselves atheists, but a deep reverence and connection to nature and this feeling of like, I've been here before. I can't believe I'm here again. Mm. Why? And then also just sort of a presencing, a feeling of not aloneness. And it's only in recent years have I even come to sort of pay attention to Jesus and what he was saying and then start to separate it from the stories that have been told in the centuries since, or the way that he's been defined, or, you know, and I'm like, oh, right, he didn't commit these things to pay. Like, this is a game of telephone, a cultural game, and what was lost, and what have we gotten wrong, and how has he been translated or interpreted in ways that he's been weaponized, where it's like, that's not actually anything, it has nothing to do with what he said. And his aphorisms and what he did in the world is quite stunning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who do you like to read besides mm-hmm. sort of who do you think tells like a nuanced, compelling version of history that might be slightly mm-hmm. truer? Who do you look to for sources?
I guess this one is easy for me only because I work in a divinity school. So it's a lot of me wandering like up and down a hallway being like, Warren, what do we think about original sin? You know, and then, like, Warren comes out with, so there's a lot of, that's a little bit Monday to Friday for me. But I guess one of the, and it is also part of the, so when students come in and they either want to be, you know, they nonprofit workers or social workers or a lot of chaplains and many want to be pastors or some kind of academic. So we do teach these big kind of history courses. And those ones are always the time when I get a chance to kind of like rehearse and retest my own like knowledge yeah. and assumptions. Because I'm not a Bible scholar, but I love Bible scholars. Like, for instance, I interviewed one just recently, N.T. Wright. And he writes really beautiful. He'll always write like a big, fat academic book. And then he'll write the same book in an accessible way, which God bless him for it. But he blew my mind last week when he was saying that there's this verse that's the equivalent of everything happens for a reason in the way that people read it. It's Romans 8:28. And it's that God works, you know, for the good of all those who love him. And that's how it usually reads. And that sounds like, oh gosh, like if you are good, then God will divinely conspire to make all the details work out. And that sounds really nice and also something I'm pretty sure I don't agree with. And he was like, oh, no. The actual translation is like God works alongside all those, you know, who love him. And it was like this, it was this wonderful translation of the cooperation God wants to have with all those who are trying to do good for others. And he's yeah. like, no, this is actually the right translation. I was like, I love a good Bible scholar for helping me. But so people like that really do encourage and inspire and challenge my own assumptions that I know what I'm reading. I also just really, really like historical theology, which is basically like just, you know, history of theological ideas over time. I do read a lot yeah. of that. And but in those cases, I usually just read my friends, Warren Smith, Stephen Chapman, you know, people I work with.
It is anyone who's listening, regardless of whether you consider yourself interested in religion or not, I do think it's eye-opening. Just those subtle distinctions between a God, as you said, who's sort of doing things for you as long as you're obedient in your goodness versus a God, a universe that is co-conspiring and co-creating. And maybe it's not what you would choose, right? You would never like look at the menu and say like, yes, stage 4 cancer, young child at home, perfect.
Yes, exactly.
And yet yes. at the same time, like one of the sort of stunning things about this like living project
yeah.
being on this planet is what we yeah. experience, what we endure, and what we become.
Yes.
Rather than
yes.
a linear life. Right?
Perfectly said. That is so perfectly said. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I could not agree with that more.
Yeah. And it's not fun necessarily.
It's not fun necessarily will be my new memoir title. Thank you for that. That's perfect.
It's not always a great time, but it is meaningful. You know, and it's interesting too. I don't know if have you ever interviewed Pauline Boss? Who wrote, she coined that term ambiguous loss. And so she's written several academic books about it, but sort of came up with this like idea, these losses that are not so easily codified, right? And certainly not necessarily recognized as cultural rights, where you're like, oh, there's a funeral because there's a body, right? So it's like victims of 9/11, IAs, extreme homesickness, like before the time of telecommunication, yeah. ghosting, miscarriage, et cetera. And she talks about sort of the essential quality of meaning making in terms of people being able to reorient themselves. And yet, certain things in life have no meaning. And that inherently is a meaning, which I thought was so beautiful because she's saying, you know, she's like, you can't say your child is murdered. You're not supposed to like find the meaning, right? Yeah. find the value, but like meaningless is a meaning.
Yes.
Which is so hard.
That's a really nice like set. Parsing those things, I do think that's really good, hard work for all of us when we are trying to decide like what stories we tell ourselves about why something happened. Because sometimes, depending on like the nature of our burden, we need to tell different stories. People with, you know, addiction write to me all the time and say, there's parts of this story that I need to be able to say, I can act my way out of. This happened because I made these choices. And then there are parts, of course, that happened to me, the likes of which I could never have set up. And so when we're always trying to decide, what does something mean? To me, the next always inevitable question is like, then what, how then do I act now that I know? And in some cases, you kind of just have to like turn to face the abyss for a hot minute, you know, where you're like, oh, I didn't get to choose. And then the other times we have to then say, what do I have now such that I can choose the next beautiful, difficult, hard, lovely thing? And watching people make those choices, it creates awe in me. Every time I see someone like take a horrible thing and then figure out that next little sliver of agency, I could watch that all day.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today. This is hard to tease out, but you think about our animal nature, right? Like the very qualities of humanness, like our fear, our response to threat, the ways in which we are mammalian, right? Like that we are just animals on this planet trying to make good choices. And then those moments when we can sort of not overcome, but those transcendent states where you do begin to affect the world and not be affected by the world. But it's that dance. I think so often we also just want to like affect the world, control certainty, instead of saying like, well, you're going to be dropping, you're living in both, friends.
Yes.
You're not masters of the world, unfortunately. As much as we constantly want to, quote unquote, overcome, right? Or get over something or get on top of something.
Yeah.
How do you, in those moments where you feel fear, where you feel your animal nature, where you don't get to be transcendent, how do you?
Yes, absolutely. That's a perfect way of putting it. When those moments when you are not in any way transcendent, when you are made of plastic and garbage and ice cream.
Yeah. How do you like work with your fear?
Yeah. Wow. Because some things hit what I think of as like the emergency button, capital E, capital B, you know, where you're like pull a thread and then you're like not wearing a sweater anymore. You're like, oh God. And I have some of those buttons where for a bit, nothing seems louder to me than this is awful. This is terrible. I can't figure this out. I'm never going to overcome this. And I've had feelings like that recently where I realize it's like a particular chord that gets mashed. Usually it's like urgency. Oh no, I have limited time and it might be too late. The feeling of like withdrawal of something I can never get back. Mm. You know, a relationship is gone. A thing is over. A dream has died. That kind of feeling. So like urgency plus a loss plus then my immediate shame. And it's like, bam, bam, bam. And then it's over. And then I find that my fear is so loud. And I have loved in those moments having the kind of friends who are not just friends, but they're like a witness to your life where they say, oh, love, these buttons feel really familiar to you. I know it really feels like you can't make a choice right now. I just want to affirm that like, it does feel that urgent. That is a real loss. I know it feels like you can't do something next. So that has really helped me get past the initial like flooding feeling that fear can bring. But I think the other bit I've just been trying to learn is that not all fear feels the same. And for a bit, the harder my life got, the more I kind of mushed them up and put them all in the same bag. So I've been scared of cancer treatment for such a long time. I feel sort of hyper alert. I get really, and then, I used to have to travel all the time for medical travel. So I'd walk into an airport and I'd be like, my skin would prickle. I was having these like just awful saliva run thin kind of feeling. And then I realized, I think you need to start learning a clear vocabulary for fear. There could be thrill. There could be excitement. There could be anxiousness. There could be physical worry. There could be just hyper anticipation. So I started doing dumb things like zip lining because I'd cry half the time. And then I was like, oh no, this is actually just you metabolizing fear. Or I talk to people about their scary experiences and I try to ask them, like, because I find sometimes that just like you, just the right word can kind of help shade out some of the different colors of how scary fear is on a cellular level to us.
Yeah. No, I think about it too as, and I think maybe this is the invitation of this next stage of my life as someone who really has had my stuff together and have experienced gradations of loss, but nothing catastrophic. Although I think that the story of humanity is like nothing is catastrophic until you're dead. And then even then, is that a catastrophe? We don't know, right? Maybe it's just an invitation. But I think too about just fear of darkness, fear of chaos, fear of allowing, and the way that culturally we've assigned so many values to the night, to darkness, to the womb, the void, whatever you want to call it. And it's like, well, what if we actually just go into it? What happens?
Yeah. I like that a lot. I mean, what happens if we just take that little extra half step toward it? I mean, sometimes we find that we're really not that bad at it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that takes a minute for our eyes to adjust to the light, but like, I meet people all the time that were positive that they could never possibly, thrive with that little, love, water, light, like all the things that you imagine makes life, that natural growth. But man, are people a wonder when they are stripped down to the studs? I think people find that they are capable of incredible love for other people, that they're suddenly very like empathy just gets like turned right up because they know the burdens of their own pain. I find that people are really then attuned to what life doesn't require anymore. Turns out email would probably be the first thing to go in that universe. But I think darkness, ironically, has such a bright quality to it when we kind of just scoot up a little closer.
Yeah. Well, and it's like the yin yang, like the counterpolarities, like things doesn't exist. Lightness doesn't exist without darkness and shadow. And we're so scared of it. And yet at the same time, it's like, this is our invitation to wholeness.
Yeah.
All of the stuff that we're afraid of is what completes this whole project.
I guess I always worry about becoming brittle, because I think I like did kind of a good job with the initial horror show that was cancer. And then I was like, I learned my lessons. But then I have been a little worried that having that kind of like buoyancy you're describing where you can just kind of soften up in it rather than be like, good God, I did this before. I've already become this person. I don't want to do it again. But I kind of wonder if survival is like doing what you're describing for the fourth time.
Yeah.
As opposed to the first or second, which didn't feel character building.
How do you think about qualities like, sort of thinking of this idea of goodness, like good and prosperity, if you're good, good things happen. If you're bad, that bad things happen. Yeah. What do you think is badness? What do you think that evil exists? How would you even, what is that?
Yeah.
In your worldview?
Yeah, I do think evil exists. I think, and I, there's just like a, there is a lovely theological term for it that I've always found really satisfying. And it's because most of our, I think, secular paradigm for good and bad is, you know, we can put all kinds of things on that spectrum. But I think we imagine in our culture that, like, you know, we imagine, like, in very therapeutic terms, like a self-expression, individuation, you know, and then maybe some like bonus service, but like that for the most part, there's kind of a flowering self-expression. And then the bad bit would be like deformation into, you know, groupthink or oppression or, you know, mm-hmm. a lack of self-expression. And I guess I still really like the growth paradigm that the therapeutic has really taught us, but I really, really like the theological term for growth, just that you, that is sanctification, that we really can sort of, in becoming more fully ourselves and more fully human, that we are simultaneously, hopefully, sort of like sloughing off some of the bullshit that mm-hmm. then really does comprise evil. Selfishness, instrumentalization, oppression, lack of justice, you know, all the things that are like, so I do like the sense that progress can be, and that's why I love the language of holiness. It's like we can grow more sacred as we become more human, but that does require the opposite of it, which is that we can, just also devolve. And oftentimes that's, tragedy does that too. We just become a real dick. Having realized scarcity of resources, we're like, good, I'll get mine.
Yeah.
And that, that's, I think, turns away from other.
Yeah. I think that's beautiful. And like in a Jungian matter, you just think about like the dense shadow. And I agree. I think our job as humans is to own those shadowy parts, recognize we're all capable of evil, fear, being pushed by fear, scarcity into behaviors that we would condemn in others, and that it's our job to sort of be present with that and to be alchemists, like just exposing that shadow to light, moving it, processing it, getting bigger, getting more whole, not by disavowing those parts, but by owning them and recognizing like you can't escape these human instincts. They are part of us. But, and I think we get into trouble when we sort of otherize evil. We turn it into Satan or whatever. And maybe that exists. I don't understand it in the model of like, if God is everything, then isn't that God too? How do you understand that?
Yeah.
Sort of this, we're not going to be trapped by this war that we have with evil or the bad people over there, sort of this binary instinct.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, because I spent a weird, you are like encroaching on a part of my brain that is like really loves to talk, really loves to talk about it because I spent so long, I mean, gosh, at least 15 years in a part of Christianity that does talk a lot about Satan and evil. And so I've seen exorcisms. I've had people try to exorcise me. I'm weirdly chill. You and I are wired very similarly. So, because there's like a very ethnographic interest in everything. So I'm like, oh, sure. What's going on? Oh, no, please stop trying to cast these demons out of me, which just happened like at least half a dozen times. So I guess I have thought a lot about how people spiritually describe what they think evil and then the personification of that would be in their mind, which is could be, you know, demonic spirits or Satan. And I think so much of it comes from, like an oppositional sense of like, God is love, God is whatever. So therefore, why do we, like what you described before, like the presencing?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a perfect word. And so why does it feel sometimes like the things that undo us are so compelling that they feel like they overtake us? And so the personification of evil becomes such a natural inclination. It also helps us have compassion for people who seem overtaken by things that are so terrible that we can't, we need another answer to like, but how could they possibly mm-hmm. have done that?
Yeah.
And it helps us ritualize and separate from things that do take our lives apart. So people then talk about, you know, I'm not saying it's helpful, but demonization of like physical ailments. It's mm-hmm. in one way, it's also trying to affirm the goodness of what someone is supposed to be. So it kind of has like it has a really interesting effect on groups and how we think about our deepest dreams for our lives, that we could be, you know, whole and healthy. But I think we've all met people where we're like, what has taken over? Like, who is driving that bus? And yeah. I think it's an easier answer for people to say forces that are beyond them.
High schoolers are busy, but no one's too busy to help fight cancer. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is looking for their next Student Visionaries of the Year. Could that be your child? High schoolers who participate in the 7-week philanthropic leadership development program gain valuable life skills like project management, communication, financial literacy, and entrepreneurship. Forming strong teams behind them, they fundraise for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society in honor of a pediatric blood cancer survivor right in their local community. Most importantly, this campaign is an opportunity for high schoolers to engage in meaningful work within their community and make a real impact on the lives of blood cancer patients and their families. Sound like something your child might be interested in? You can learn more about Student Visionaries of the Year or even nominate a student at lls.org/students. That's lls.org/students. Do you personally have any, it's like a question that's consuming for me, unsurprisingly, where I'm like, what is it? And I recognize it as extreme shadow and also as like an archetypal energy or force that can be very distorting. Yeah. I don't know that I could say like it has I can't quite anthropomorphize it.
Yeah, I hear you. You know? I love that this worries you. It worries, I think about this stuff too a lot. So it actually worries me too.
Well, you see it, right? You see people and you watch them get bent. You big, big cultural people. And you're like, oh, I see if you sort of start as an amoral entity, I can see these people getting bent, distorted. Mm-hmm. And what is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I really haven't spiritually put a lot of energy into imagining like a personification of evil who is like working to my detriment all the time. I have not. Though I do think that it is so genuinely hard to be good sometimes. Yeah. Like that the greatest evils are not, you know, murder or any of the other exciting sins. I mean, that's terrible. PSA, please don't murder. But I find that the most compelling ones are just always the easiest ones. Like, mm-hmm. you know, slander, condescension, jealousy, withdrawal, our deep desire to have a lack of love and call it, oh my gosh, and lately call it self-care. I'm obsessed with these news stories about people who choose great evil, but they mask it in like, I just really had to choose me. What? Because it is, you know, because most of what is like good and I think holy and lovely also just doesn't have a great reason for it. Like we look at Mother Teresa and people like that with awe and a little confusion because sometimes the path to good requires so much self-sacrifice that like we want a million other reasons to not choose that road. So I'm not saying the monastic ideal is like the only one that helps us like create a distinction between good and bad, but I do find that most of our conception of evil is so exaggerated because the evil we would choose is already so acceptable to us.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I guess I think of it too, just listening to you and I just think of it as like a density or not a gravitational pull, because I also like take issue with the way that our culture is structured as like, we just need to get out of here and up there, like the ascension, instead of sort of recognizing it as a cycle of bringing us down and deeper into ourselves. And then and before we go up, you know, some sort of spiral. That. But there is a density, a tarriness, I think, to some of those sticky instincts.
Yeah.
That
I find evil is a really helpful category when I think about like structural evil. When I, you know, I almost bankrupted my family with medical bills. I have spent tens of hundreds of what feels like thousands of hours on the phone with someone named Linda, who is hired by a company designed to have sent me an insane and absolutely irrational bill for two needles that will then, you know, prevent anyone I love from keeping their bungalow. Or, for example, the future of genetic testing that will be all of our information will be bought by companies that will be then used to exclude my offspring from receiving fair access to healthcare. Like, we don't really have to look very far around us to know that genuine evil rules the primary logic of structures that like do us harm. And so in those versions, I sometimes feel like the personification of it helps give me a better sense of justice and a stronger sense of like, these are, as you know, my preacher friends would say, powers and principalities. And they would use language like that. And I find it very dramatic and I sort of find it helpful.
Yeah. Well, I think structure of any kind, shape, right? So that it's not so amorphous. And I, you know, because I feel this way, or this is what I was trying to do in On Our Best Behavior, was to sort of give shape and structure to sort of an oppressive, dominance-based patriarchy in the way that it shows up in our lives, instead of saying sort of using language where it's like it, they, it becomes sort of a boogeyman where you're like, what are we even talking about? And how is this alive in us? Or systemic racism is another example where you're like, actually, You have to define it. Yes. You can't just deny it.
Yeah.
And what is a system of misogyny? What is a system of racism? What is a system of healthcare? You know, whatever it is, like, then you can start to undo it.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you're sort of casting around at this, like, terror in a way that feels maddening.
I do. It's funny. I think you're totally right that our language for evil can be so broad, like so, so diffuse and amorphous that it can't name things that undo us.
Yeah.
Like clinical trial consent protocols, just to name one. But it can also then be so individualistic that it's like only the Unabomber, you know, only. And who, you know, just we do get caught, especially in American, I think, religion, where we either go hyper individualistic and we imagine each person along this sort of path of individual progress, or so collective in our imagination that we have no account of, I think, our own sin and our own progress.
And our own culpability and our own adherence, our own involvement or engagement with these systems. And I think the last few years and decades have been so helpful and instructive, as difficult as they've been, for people to recognize, oh, right, okay, I understand systemic racism now is something that I'm participating in and I am a part of, even though I never subscribed, I never made a conscious agreement to participate in this, yet I understand how it's alive in me and alive in the world. I think it's like what has to happen, even in these conversations about any sort of structured evil, darkness, badness, is to bring it into our bodies and to say, I recognize that this is alive in me. I recognize, like, I don't want to pay a higher premium, you know, so that Kate gets appropriate care, whatever it is.
Yeah. Yes.
I want my bonus as a pharma executive, you know, all of these things that like are very easy to rationalize. But until we sort of recognize it and then identify it in ourselves, as something that's also collective, we can't undo it, I don't think.
Yeah.
To own the darkness.
Yeah. One of the reasons why I've always really loved thinking about like the cultural, like the big broad cultural scripts that we tell ourselves about how we imagine like what whether our lives are going to work out, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Lately, I've been working on a history of self-help, so I've been reading hundreds of self-help books.
Oh my God.
So I've been sort of thinking a lot about how much we expect for ourselves, what our experience of our entitlements are, really.
Yeah.
And then, because the follow-up questions is like, well, then what do we owe one another?
I love that.
I'm really hopeful that we're evolving past our very hyper-individualistic understanding of like, my health, wealth, and happiness is the great goal. And that we're trying to like fold in a more collective and I hope generous sense that like our lives will require love. Our lives will require courage and interdependence, you know, and it's probably going to never fall along any of our demographic, political, religious, sociocultural, you know, dreams that advertising companies have for us. But
yeah.
Instead it's going to require a very collective sense of what can we become.
Ooh, Kate, I can't wait. I hope is that a book for all of us, or is that an academic text?
I know. I will write it just for you. That's what I'll do.
May I please have that book? I love that. And I feel like the paradigm shift required for all of us, and the way, like, the bigger umbrella for that world is also personal responsibility. It's like, yes, individual culture has, this rugged individualism has gone so far to become depraved. And yes, there is a lot of value in cleaning up our stuff before we project it onto each other. And so it's like, it's a personal responsibility. Yes, take care of yourself, take care of your messes, and in service of something that's so much bigger than any one of us.
Yep. It's so true. If I could pick one thing that everyone would have to do that no one will do, I just want everyone to like join the Rotary Club or like some kind of Girl Scout organization, or just realize that like so much of my sense of responsibility, it no longer weekly requires that I care about things other than myself.
Yeah.
I'm imagining that at some point our endlessly book club model of what we think collective action is going to break down, and we'll just all go back to being weird Rotarians. That's my prophetic imagination.
Rotarians, that's the title. The weird Rotarians unite. I love it. Kate is a very special human with a mind I deeply admire, both for her historian sensibility, that leaning towards a larger context or frame in which to find ourselves, paired with her deep, deep humanity and the way that she lets us see her insides against this bigger tapestry of her outsides. And I also love her because she is obviously a person of deep faith and writes about religion and writes books that are memoirs and also books of blessings, but there is nothing pushy about her system of belief. In fact, I would call it really just faith, a person of faith who's willing to hold a lot of people's lives in her experience without projecting how we should all live. So I love her podcast. I love her books. I love her sensibility, and the accessibility of her feelings is really something to behold. She is not frozen or hardened. She is so soft, and all of her experiences are miraculously accessible to her, even as she's experienced many hard things. If you like today's episode, please rate and review and tell a friend. You can find show notes and full transcripts of the episodes at EliseLunan.com. While there, please sign up for my Substack. I send a short note every Wednesday about topics that are aligned with this show, and a deeper dive most Sundays. Or follow me on Instagram at Elise Lunan. And finally, if you haven't already, please consider picking up a copy of my New York Times bestselling book, On Our Best Behavior, The 7 Deadly Sins and the Price Women Pay to Be Good, available wherever you get your books. It's an exploration of how women have been conditioned for goodness, men for power, and all the ways we've been programmed to police ourselves and each other according to these cultural ideas of what it is to be a good woman. I'd also like to give a huge thank you to my sponsors who make this show possible. Please support them the way they support this podcast. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studio. If you enjoyed this episode, please listen, rate, review, and follow Pulling the Thread. Available now for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give a shout out to Phil Svitek, Lauren LaGrasso, Mary Kate McDonough, Ali Brockman, and the entire Cadence 13 team for producing these episodes, and to Valero Duvall for my key art. Take care of yourselves. I'll see you next week.